Welcome to another episode of the Colorado BQA Chat podcast. My name is Libby Bigler, and I'm the Colorado Beef Quality Assurance State Coordinator. I will also be your host for today's podcast episode. I hope you've had an opportunity to listen to some of our first episodes, whether that be cattle handling with Dr. Temple Grandin or biosecurity with NCBA's Dr. Julie Herman. We're excited to use this platform as a way to help listeners engage with the BQA program, even in times when we are restricted in terms of our ability to gather. We hope this podcast will help you apply BQA on your operation with advice and insight from folks in the beef industry who are at the leading edge of beef quality assurance. The Colorado BQA Chat podcast is brought to you by Colorado Beef Quality Assurance and is funded by the Colorado Beef Council and Colorado State University's Department of Animal Sciences. As always, if you're interested in becoming BQA or BQA transportation certified, please give me a call at 970-491-BEEF or you can log on to bqa.org. Today's guest is Dr. Lily Edwards Callaway. She's an assistant professor for livestock behavior and welfare at Colorado State University, and we're happy to have her join us. Lily, thanks for coming and being on our podcast today. We're excited to have you and talk a little bit about the welfare science that our producers can relate to in the beef industry. So with that, I kind of want to get started and just have you talk a little bit more about your background, especially considering your expertise, you know, mainly centered on welfare at slaughter, and knowing that you didn't really come from an agricultural background. Can you share with us a little bit about your journey to this point and really how you became a source on the topic of livestock slaughter welfare?
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me here today. And my story is a little bit different. So some of you might laugh while you're listening, but yeah, you're right. I grew up actually in Rhode Island, so totally different than where I am now in Colorado. I've been out in Colorado for quite some time now, but I grew up not exposed to livestock at all. You know, I went to my undergrad education was in literature. I studied French. So I did a lot of different things. I liked science, but I just, you know, I think I didn't take the opportunity to ask people, hey, what else could you do with science besides being a doctor, which seems silly that I couldn't figure that out now. But I thought about going to vet school, and I just, you know, I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to be able to impact the lives of animals in a positive way, but I think I hadn't quite found exactly what that was yet. And so I got a master's in animal science, but I actually looked at zoo animals. And it was through that work, you know, I started becoming really interested in behavior and welfare. I read some of Temple Grandin's books, and I actually reached out to her, and then she offered me an opportunity to come to Colorado State and get my PhD with her, which, you know, I think totally transitioned the way that my career trajectory went in terms of being involved in agriculture. And so when I came to Colorado State, I started doing my PhD work was in a slaughter plant, and I remember the first time I went to one, you know, we went with a big group of people, and it was kind of like, okay, this is going to be the deal breaker. Either she's going to want to work in this environment or she's not. And that was kind of the beginning of taking me to where I am today. I really enjoy that part of the industry. I think there's a lot of different areas that we can look at in that space. And so now I'm on faculty at Colorado State. I was in a similar role after grad school at Kansas State. And then in between, I've done a couple different things, but in between I did work for a big packer. So I have a lot of experience in the slaughter side of things. And then I have a lot of ties to industry. Probably my biggest one, you know, related to this podcast, I am on the National Cattlemen's Beef Association BQA Advisory Board. And so I work in that space as well.
I think that topic can kind of lead a little bit into really what I wanted you to discuss today with us. And that's really kind of the science of animal welfare that sometimes producers don't think about. And I know that our producers and our listeners today really do find animal welfare to kind of be at the core of their business. And we hear the argument all the time that, of course, I care about animal welfare. I have to have healthy, you know, comfortable animals in order to be profitable or be efficient. And I think sometimes that's maybe the wrong way to look at things if you really think about it from an animal welfare science perspective. So I guess how I wanted to kind of get into this is talk to you a little bit about, I know you've had a lot of opportunities to speak on this topic to just general audiences or producer audiences. And I know oftentimes you'll kind of survey the audience or poll your audience and talk to them about what animal welfare means to them. So to get into this subject, can you discuss a little bit about what you've found that most producers think animal welfare is? And then maybe we'll, from there, go into some of the details or the frameworks that you look to when you talk about the science behind welfare. And then we'll talk a little bit more about kind of what it really means to cattle. So first and foremost, from your perspective, what do you think cattle producers think of, or what does it mean for them to consider animal welfare on their operations?
Great. So good question. And you're right. I do like to open talk sometimes by engaging the audience and either asking, you know, what are the words that come to your mind when you think about animal welfare? I often sometimes also give them a scenario, maybe a little bit outside of their space of cows, and talk about, you know, cats or dogs or something, for example, and say, you know, here's one scenario and here's another, and what are the trade-offs? And so what kind of aspects of an animal's life do you value? And I think that tells us a lot about kind of what they prioritize and how they raise their own animals. And so I think, you know, my favorite thing is to ask, give me keywords, and then make this beautiful word cloud that's unique to every audience, because I think it's really interesting. They're always different, right? And so the things that come out when you ask a producer audience or just industry audience of what does animal welfare mean to you, animal care comes out probably as the biggest, management, health, nutrition, all those kind of really things related to basic health and functioning of an animal. So I think to your point you made kind of in that introduction, I think that we're very comfortable measuring those outcomes, and things like performance and health are foundational to our systems where we raise animals to be high performing, right? And so they're often usually very quantifiable outcomes. And so, you know, they're 100% related to animal care. And I think we have a great foundation for animal care. I think sometimes where the science is now going and this kind of communication to, you know, the industry group doesn't always happen, but I think we're looking beyond those measures of basic health and functioning to some other things that I think in our heads might seem a little bit more subjective, but there's actually ways that we can measure those when we look at the animals.
I think sometimes when you think back to the mission of the Beef Quality Assurance Program, I always mention this in my podcast episodes, but maximizing consumer confidence in beef by focusing to daily production practices, I think sometimes welfare becomes one of those things that consumers are concerned about that we can maybe use to tell a story to improve their confidence. So it's not anymore just making sure that the beef is high quality and tastes good, but there are other components. And I think welfare is one of those things that we have to look to. And to your point, sometimes I think when we say, you know, we're worried about animal care, or, you know, our performance indicators show they're performing really well, so they must be comfortable, they must be in a good state of welfare. Or if we say this is essential to our business and consumers hear that, sometimes I think that might not be good enough for them. That might sound a little too businessy and not compassionate enough. So, you know, you hear a lot of people that advocate for the industry telling that side of the story, but I think there might be another message that we can link and get out there to our consumers. And I'm not sure if you have any ideas on this, but maybe as we talk through some of the frameworks, something might come out that one of our listeners can say, oh, this might actually connect better with our consumers than just saying, you know, it's critical to our business or something like that.
Yeah, I think that those are great points. You know, when we think about performance and health outcomes in that context, those are certainly a part of welfare assessment. And so it's not to say those can't be considered, but to your point, there's more than that. And I think we've kind of progressed to that point where generally we understand there's more than that, but we need to be able to articulate what that means to us at our facilities. And so I kind of sometimes like to think about animal welfare. You know, some people who are listening might be familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs out of human psychology. And it just kind of talks about, it's a pyramid, it's a, you know, rainbow colored pyramid. And it talks about the base needs. And then as base needs are fulfilled, it moves up that pyramid to things that are potentially a little bit more extensive in thought. And so the base of that pyramid is animal care, right? We provide food, water, shelter, veterinary care, all those really basic needs of animal care, and we're great at doing that. And then as we move up that pyramid, we think about things that are also important to the animal, like social grouping, interaction with herd mates, the opportunity to explore their environment and make choices in their environment. And so I think, you know, taking it to the next level is maybe where we need to change our narrative Because I think we do some of those things in practice.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we do those things. We just aren't sure how to talk about them. And as you said, maybe for producers, they're not as easily quantifiable as saying, you know, we ride pens twice a day in a feedlot, or, you know, we provide calving assistance at calving season or whatever. Those obviously meet basic care needs. But some of those higher up the pyramid, you know, I think maybe we need to figure out how we can help educate producers on what those things are, and then be able to tell that story to the consumer a little bit further throughout the supply chain. So I think those are really good points that you bring up, Lily, and things that I think are good topics of discussion and things that we can maybe add into some of our BQA programming in the future.
Yeah, and I think to that comment, just as you're speaking, I'm thinking of these things. I think when we look at the ways that we assess animal welfare and some of the frameworks around it, there's a big push to including more aspects of mental health. So the psychological state of the animal, because we've kind of really talked about the physical thing, right? The performance, the health, but this mental component is critical to welfare. If we think about our welfare, it is, right? The other thing to consider is that a lot of the frameworks that, you know, are kind of current in the animal welfare science space right now really focus on two additional things that I think we haven't necessarily done as well in the past. So we talked about, you know, performance indicators, for example. That's really those physical components of welfare. The other really important component of welfare is the psychological component. So the mental state of the animal, how it feels about its environment, which I think is critical. And then the other thing, I think just generally as humans, maybe even outside of the welfare space, we tend to measure the negative things, right? And so we want to reduce the occurrence of negative experiences. But what really people talk about now is we don't want it to be just neutral, right? We don't want to reduce the negative experiences and have this neutral state. We want to really promote the positive experiences of those animals. And, you know, kind of a quote from some of these frameworks is we want to give those animals a life worth living. So that goes beyond just getting rid of things that are negative, but really pushing opportunities for the animal to have a high quality of life.
So thinking on that same wavelength with you, are there some practical things that you can think of that we could share with our listeners that might help enhance those positive experiences rather than just eliminating negative experiences? I know sometimes I think about when you look into the five freedoms that we talk about, the freedom to express normal behavior. And sometimes I think producers maybe do create negative situations or unintentionally limit some of those freedoms to express normal behavior. But in other ways, I think what we could look at is maybe how do we enhance some of those? And I really do, it depends kind of on your, whatever segment of production you're in, if you're a cow-calf producer, if you're running a feedlot, but are there things in there that you can think that might be practical or maybe some easy things to implement when it comes to maybe something like a freedom to express normal behavior, how we can promote those positives?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's a tricky question, right? Because I think depending on the system we're in, there obviously are limitations to doing some of these things. But I think, so if we can provide the animals with opportunities for some sort of choice in their environment, which I know is hard, right? Because we generally provide them with their diet unless they're in an open system, then they do get to kind of have choice in where they graze and what they do to some degree. So I think it's a challenge. So I just want everyone to recognize that, you know, we understand that it's not just a simple, oh yeah, I'm going to snap my fingers and come up with this great option. So, but I think if we think about that, so social groups is one thing. I think in a lot of systems, yes, we house the animals in social groups. In some, we don't necessarily. And so I think exploring, are we giving these animals an opportunity to make choices about the individuals within their herd that they spend time with? And so, you know, in a group setting that animals can engage, that's important and critical. I think the example in my head is really with calf housing and dairy. And I think that doesn't necessarily apply to the audience that we might be talking to today. But just as an example, I think individual calf housing is a management practice that is being looked at as maybe one that we can change to either paired housing or group housing to really provide those calves with an opportunity for social interaction. So that's just one example. I think another thing that's becoming more and more explored is enrichment. And so enrichment could be providing, you know, opportunity to engage with herd mates. But enrichment could also be, you know, putting some sort of thing in the environment that animal can interact with. So I think about you know, dairies once again, but I've seen this in feedlots too, and I've even seen some slaughter plants trying it. Those big brushes, just for kind of other opportunities for self-grooming on the brushes or interacting with brushes. If we think about other species like pigs, you know, some sort of opportunity to engage and explore using their snouts with an item. You know, animals are very exploratory and also very exploratory with their mouths, and so providing something for them to interact with that way. And then the other thing I think that we probably don't actually think about as enrichment, but I think is maybe something that would be the one of the easier things for us to think about, would be human-animal interaction. So how our caretakers are engaging with the animals. And so I think we all know that those interactions, it's really helpful if they're positive, but I think we probably haven't dug as deep into understanding, you know, that the interactions that animals have with individuals at a facility is going to impact how they interact with any sort of individual that they interact with later on down the supply chain. Animals can discriminate between different people, and so they can kind of like to engage with some and not like to engage with others. And so I think really promoting those positive interactions is something that we could focus on as a form of kind of providing animals more enrichment with their within their environment.
I think those are all interesting points that you make. And even though your examples maybe aren't within the beef industry, like when we talk a lot about dairies, it makes sense that there are some ideas and opportunities stirring with those dairies just because of the way that they do manage cattle, a little bit more confined maybe than our cow-calf and stocker operators. And like you said, individual housing with calves is something that we don't do a whole lot here in the beef side of the industry, but things to think about that can help us maybe change our mindset or reference when we think about what we're doing with our cattle operations on the beef side. I was also thinking, you know, you mentioned giving them choices, but you know, people that run feedlots, you say, well, in terms of their environment, you know, we have them in this pen and this is the pen. But even something I think you and I worked on a little bit over the summer was talking about shade for cattle, even if maybe you gave them an option to have shade versus not having right. shade or things like that. Those are different choices that would kind of help enrich their environment or give them opportunities to move up a tier on that pyramid, not just meeting their basic function levels. So I think those are really good examples, Lily, and I appreciate those. So I guess, you know, I kind of want to move on again and back to the consumer side of things, because I do think a lot of this stuff is, you know, we should be considering this even if consumers aren't asking about it, but they really are starting to ask about it. And so one of the things I wanted to mention and bring up, and I've seen you talk about this on some of your slideshow presentations, is it seems like, especially lately, we've seen a big increase in the amount of label claims on beef or anything really, any products, animal products that represent some level of improved animal welfare. So animal welfare certified products or things like that. You know, I understand it's one of the few ways that we are able to currently like reach consumers who are concerned about those things. But from your perspective, do you think it would be valuable for a producer to participate in one of those programs on the welfare side of things? I know a lot of people right now probably participate in age and source verified or non-hormone treated, but specifically in those welfare labeled programs, if it's practical for them to do so, do you think it's something that would be beneficial to them?
So I think to your last comment, if it's practical for them to do it and there's an economic return on that, then I think that's, you know, a business decision in doing it. I think there's certainly a market for it, as you mentioned. If we think about animal welfare kind of in the space of marketing, I think probably several years ago, I mean, maybe I can even say decades ago, people started really focusing on welfare because it was a risk in the system, right? You wanted to minimize that risk. And then I think things shifted to saying, actually, it's not just avoiding risk, it's actually we can promote this and use it to our marketing advantage. Right, wrong, or indifferent, I think that's kind of the space that we live in. So I think some of those decisions are based around that. Is it worth kind of making any adjustments to be part of that program? Do you believe in that program? I think is a key consideration, which we don't often talk about. And then is there an economic incentive to doing that? I think if we think about the welfare of the animals in those systems, I think that you can have great welfare on farm and not be part of a certified welfare program. And I think you can have great welfare and be part of a certified program, and then also the reverse, right? I think a lot of those programs have a lot of similarities in what their requirements are, similarities to each other, similarities to BQA. Some are more about certain, like, providing required things, whether that's access to pasture or something like that, or pain management, for example. And then some are also things that have, like, prohibited practices within them. So I think the nature of those programs are a little bit specific to the missions of what those programs are. I think sometimes once they get onto the food label and you see them in the store, I think some of that is lost, except to maybe the consumers that dig deep enough to really understand those nuances. So I think, I guess my short answer is it really depends, but I think you can have good welfare or bad welfare, no matter what kind of system you have, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I like the point that you make that, you know, if it's practical, it makes sense, and that you can, you know, good welfare or bad welfare can happen no matter if you are enrolled in these programs or not. The ones that you are enrolled in, I think if you do decide to, I think it's important, a really important point that you brought up was that you do believe in that program. If it's something that you really believe in and that you want to work to achieve that level, I think that can be really valuable. But at the same time, I think that there's other things that you can think about that maybe you don't get a label claim on, but in general, as we go through and talk about beef quality assurance and over 80% of cattle in the country being managed under BQA guidelines, I think that's one way that we need to try to start informing consumers of welfare, that we've got this standard program, that a lot of things that are part of the BQA program really do link to animal welfare. And so just because it's on a label doesn't mean that those are the only ones that are, you know, treated well in the minds of consumers. So I think that's an interesting point that you make as well. And I think that there are some opportunities for people that if you want to try to get into some of those programs, some are kind of tiered or stair step. So you maybe don't have to be the most extreme levels that whatever program decides is their, you know, utmost standard of animal welfare, but you can be on a different scale within that program and still see some of the benefits and value from becoming part of a welfare certified labeling claim.
Yeah. And I would say that BQA is really the kind of standards and guidelines and foundations to BQA are nestled within those programs, right? They might have additional things on top of it, but I think if you're already in the BQA space, the jump might not be as big as it might seem, right?
Right, absolutely. I think that leads into kind of my next question for you. The Beef Quality Assurance Program just recently released a new industry-wide feed yard audit tool. And as we mentioned earlier, they're working on updating that cow-calf assessment tool with some of the research that you and I and students at CSU are working on. But from your perspective, and I think you kind of just answered this question, do you think that these audits and assessments are beneficial to overall cattle well-being? And are there specific components within there that you think address some welfare concerns kind of in a scientific way?
Yeah, so I think the key to these assessments and the thing that we're seeing with the revising of the cow-calf and then the kind of new feed yard audit is that they're living documents, right? They're dynamic. And so I think that's something that we can really talk about maybe a little bit more. So, you know, welfare changes, focus changes, technology changes. And so we have to adapt what we're looking at to represent kind of where we're at in a production setting. And so I think the thing that makes me really happy is we revise those things and we look at the current status and some issues that have popped up or benchmarking needs or whatever it is. And then we kind of adapt those audits and include new things. And so, you know, I don't think things don't need to be revised every 6 months, but they do need to be revised so that we can include those. And I think just the example I'm thinking in the feed yard audit, prior mobility wasn't included in there as something to measure. And that's been added because for the past several years, kind of the focus on fed cattle mobility has come to the surface. There are a lot of benchmarking efforts, and we recognize, you know, that is something that would be a great animal-based outcome that we can include in an audit that's important.
That's a great point. I think it's excellent that we're able to and make it a priority to update all of our resources, including these audits and assessments that we have in the BQA program. And I think that that leads into kind of one of my shameless plugs. If you are BQA certified and you don't get certified every 3 years, you think one certification is fine because it's too repetitive. Well, I think Lily just outlined it really well, is that a lot of these documents are living documents. They're always changing. They're always being updated. And I think the schedule that the national program tries to stick to is about 3 years. They go through and update their online modules, and they're continuously providing us as BQA state coordinators with new information that we need to include in our trainings to keep our producers on kind of the leading edge of beef quality assurance so that we can make sure that those certifications are relevant and meeting the needs of the goal of the program, which is ultimately to improve consumer confidence. So make sure that you maintain your BQA certification, keep it up to date. It's a 3-year certification period. So you should get reminders if you're in Colorado through an email that your certification is about to expire. And that should help kind of keep that top of mind for you. So that's a really good point, Lily. And thanks for bringing that up so that we could kind of plug, you know, getting your BQA certification and recertifying and staying up to date with that. So I really think in general, from your perspective, and this is kind of a good way to sum everything up, from your perspective and the work that you do on a daily basis, especially regarding welfare, how does that all just kind of complete the circle and relate back to beef quality assurance in general?
Well, I think, you know, producers do such a great job focusing on the quality of life of an animal. So they're responsible for, you know, everything from birth up into the day they leave to go to the terminal market where I spend most of my time. But I think, you know, producers spend a lot of time, a lot of effort really making sure that animal has a good quality of life. And so I guess when the responsibility passes over to the slaughter plant, I think one, there's a lot of things we can measure to help kind of inform about the prior process and give feedback. And then the other, I think it's kind of understanding that even though that terminal kind of marketing process is maybe not a large portion of the animal's life, it's a very critical portion. And it's kind of taking everything together, that all the effort that was put in, and making sure we do it right. And so that's where I see myself fitting in into the process. I think that as much as we focus on giving them a good life, we've also got to give them a good death. And that's where I find that I can make the most impact.
We're really lucky to have you at CSU, Lily. I think that some of the research that you've done and some of the improvements that you're making in that slaughter space on animal welfare are second to none. And like I said, I think CSU is, we're glad to have you, and you're a great addition to our beef quality assurance team there on campus. And I think a wealth of knowledge and providing some perspectives to our listeners and our producers that maybe we haven't thought about in the past, but it's highly critical that we think about those things in the future as we move forward. So with that, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. I want to let our listeners know that if you ever have any questions for Lily or myself, you can always contact me. And with that, I just thank you for being with me today and giving a good perspective of welfare, particularly on the slaughter side of things, and then some of those practical things that producers can do to think more about welfare from a different perspective. So thank you, Lily.
Thank you. This was great.
Thank you to all the listeners who've tuned in and continue to support the BQA program in Colorado. Thank you to the Colorado Beef Council and Colorado State University Department of Animal Sciences for sponsoring the Colorado BQA Chat podcast and Colorado's BQA program. Beef Quality Assurance is a nationally coordinated, state-implemented producer education and certification program that works to build consumer confidence in beef by focusing producers' attention to daily production practices that influence the safety, wholesomeness, and quality of beef and beef products. Remember, you can earn your BQA certification for free at any time at www.bqa.org. For in-person certification options, please contact me at the Colorado BQA office, 970-491-BEEF. Thank you, and we look forward to having you join us next time.